In today's episode, we're joined by author and psychiatrist Dr. Claire Payne. Dr. Payne helps us to better understand how trauma is specifically different from other types of strong emotions, such as grief or shame. She also shares with us the impacts of sexual abuse and betrayal, and she breaks down the groundbreaking adverse childhood event study that directly correlates specific types of childhood trauma with early all-cause morbidity and mortality.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Inspire Health Podcast, and thanks for tuning into our continued series on trauma recovery. Today's guest is Dr. Claire Payne. Dr. Payne is an associate professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Toronto. She's director of the Psychological Trauma Program at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. And in July 2014, she was awarded an honorary doctorate from Addis Ababa University, AAU, for her work to assist the development of psychiatry in Ethiopia. Her clinical focus is on the assessment and treatment of patients, including refugees, who continue to suffer from the effects of psychological trauma. She has lectured and taught on various aspects of psychological trauma, including transcultural issues, and increasingly on global mental health. She has published a number of articles and three books, Trauma and the Body, A Sensory-Motor Approach to Psychotherapy with Pat Ogden and Kakuni Minton, The Impact of Early Life Trauma on Health and Disease, The Hidden Epidemic, a book with Eric Vermetten and Ruth Lanius, and Psychotherapy Essentials to Go, Achieving Psychotherapy Effectiveness. Dr. Payne, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thanks so much for being a part of this really important series.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Jason.
My pleasure. So, Dr. Payne, I'm wondering if first you can just give us a little bit of an overview of your background and how you decided to make trauma recovery such a huge part of your life's professional work.
Thank you. I became a psychiatrist, and my first job, I was the only woman. When I became a psychiatrist, I was absolutely sure all I wanted to do was psychotherapy, kind of psychodynamic psychotherapy. And I was the only woman in an busy outpatients department of a hospital. And all my male colleagues said, oh, thank God, we've got a woman psychiatrist, now you can deal with all these poor abused patients. And I thought, no, I have no desire to do that. That's not my, you know, I knew my goal. And then I actually enjoyed this hospital very much. It's actually a very biological hospital. And psychotherapy was not big there. So I suddenly realized that PTSD, or when events happen, it can change people's lives. They were fine one day, kind of, and they're not fine the next day. And this is actually perfect. You know, PTSD is where the wheels hit the ground. Through a psychological experience, people change, can be very severely affected. So I suddenly realized it's perfect. It's a perfect example of how words are so important in the helping people recover or finding their way to recovery. It's a great teaching tool. And most important of all, I found the patients entirely compelling. I remember one young woman came in, sort of trailing her, you know, we're in Canada, so trailing her scarf and her book, her bag and stuff, sort of not great, not seeming to be doing well. And after 6 months, you know, she was a university student and had her books under her arm and going out with a different kind of walk, a different degree of confidence. And I suddenly realized patients with unresolved trauma are very compelling patients. And they are already, before they walk into your room, half the time they're on their way to recovery. And you can't say the same for schizophrenia or serious mood disorders. So compelling, and I feel I learn a great deal. I learn from every patient I see who's a trauma patient, and 30 years later, it somehow doesn't seem stale.
What areas have you ended up making more of your focus, and how did you end up arriving at those specific areas?
My two major foci in Canada are refugees. I work in two different refugee mental health clinics in downtown Toronto. So they're people who've come from very difficult situations and are trying to, they're requesting refugee status here in Canada, or refugee claim, convention refugee status on the way to becoming a permanent resident and ultimately a Canadian citizen. Very interesting people, because I'd started my career with homegrown, lovely Canadians who'd had bad childhoods, bad marriages, maybe lost some kids to CAS. Alcohol and drugs have featured in their lives. You know, they've had very tough lives. So that was one group. And then I started working with refugees. And it's not that I'm comparing the two overtly, but I was stunned when I listened to refugees tell me the most awful stories. And yet they were fine. I mean, they were rattled and they were suffering, but they had no mental health disorder. They needed settlement services. They needed some things to help them get settled, to find their feet in Canada. But most of them didn't even have PTSD. And I think it drew my attention very helpfully to how vitally important it is that childhoods really vitally determine much of how, not all, but much of how we respond when disaster strikes as an adult.
So you found, would you find that those refugees that you had worked with, were they actually traumatized then?
They had had terrible, terrible experiences, but no matter whether they were a former Yugoslavian Serb or a Dinka tribesman, they'd had childhoods where they were cherished and respected. And so, and it's compatible with the literature, but as adults, they had some, because of that kind of childhood, they had some capacity to manage, or they had some resilience that enabled them to manage as best they could with a horrible situation. I want to emphasize, it's not that they didn't suffer, but they didn't get a mental health condition. Whereas I think many of my patients who have had terrible childhoods struggle more to access their resilience, to develop and access their resilience.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me to a question then. How do you describe trauma? And how is trauma different from other types of suffering, such as grief or neglect or something along those lines? What's the difference?
I always laugh with our residents in the hospital and say, you know, these days we medicalize language. So, if I go to a shoe shop, a sale, and the sale has ended, or the sale is somebody's bought the pair of shoes that I was waiting to go on sale, I'm going to say to my family, oh my God, it was so traumatic, you know. And so we have changed in a way everything by no longer having the kind of language we've had for centuries to describe various kinds of suffering that are kind of ubiquitous. We all go through it sooner or later, one way or the other. So for me, I'm a bit picky. I keep trauma as a traumatic experience is an experience that has involved fear, horror, and helplessness, which is kind of the DSM-4 criteria, 4TR criteria. It's about being trapped and terrified, and it gives rise to a different kind of physiology, and it gives rise to a different kind of model you need to treat it. Mm-hmm. As we all know, complex PTSD is quickly, there's no such thing as PTSD in a way. It's so quickly comorbid or is accompanied anyway by depression, anxiety, maybe panic, alcohol, substance abuse disorders, isolation, problem at work, problem with friends, problem with family. So it very quickly becomes something else that involves a whole lot of other emotions. But for me, trauma, unresolved trauma, begins with terror. And terror you can't get away from. We, you know, everybody, I don't actually, but a lot of people pay a lot of money to go see horror movies. It's not my thing, but, you know, it's kind of cool. You can kind of modify what you see. You can cuddle up with your significant other. There's a way in which we play with fear in order perhaps to understand it better or to resolve in some ways fear. I think, what did, am I right? Aristotle. Somebody smart like that said theater is about resolving fear and pity. So there is a way in which fear is part of our heritage and something we all have to grapple with from the earliest of infancies. But in psychiatry anyway, residents are very quick to describe depression. Mm-hmm. But I feel there's not enough training for all of us around fear, disorders that originate with fear.
Well, and that's interesting that you even mentioned theater, because whether it was Aristotle or someone else smart, but
Socrates.
One of that group, Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, one of them.
Maybe Plato, yeah.
But even the mention of theater is, that's actually one of the therapies that a lot of times people are incorporating now to help work with theater, with trauma, it sounds like. I know Bessel van der Kolk was talking about that. That's one of the big ones that they incorporate, is theater work to be able to, again, almost play with different roles and play with different experiences in a way that lets them almost filter it without getting restuck with it.
Yeah, and I think that's wonderful. When I think of the patients who I have or I have had with PTSD, and I'm actually thinking of Rwandan genocide survivors, there's no play. They live their life, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to mention any details whatsoever, but on the surface, their lives are productive. They're working with families, but almost every minute of the day, they're trying not to get hijacked by triggers in their environment that give them the worst flashbacks I've ever seen in my life. So I think theater is wonderful. I think these things are all parts of staged treatment. But I'm in the very, very lucky position as a Canadian psychiatrist that I see people who are poor, who can't afford a non-OHIP therapist. And I don't know sometimes all of us, or psychiatrists in Canada, see a different kind of a group of patients who perhaps teach us slightly different things. But on the whole, I believe that, and you, one of your questions later on is about procedural and explicit memory or implicit and explicit memory. I do think we have to do some work in helping a person to experience and express their unresolved traumatic experience in words before they can really start making meaning and reflect. I'm just not sure how you move ahead. Mm. The body work can certainly help with that, but it's very clear from Pat's work and what she says that her work is in conjunction with language.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
One thing that was interesting when I was talking to Ruth Lanius too, and looking at some of the work there, was she does a lot of work with the functional MRIs and whatnot and brain scans and sort of seeing what's going on. Where does language play into it with, it seems, and maybe you can explain this a little bit better to me, but it seems like sometimes, depending on what's going on or how that person processed the trauma, sometimes different areas in the brain get literally downregulated or don't work so well or get shut down. And if those are an area that is tied with kind of language in that, how do you mitigate that? Where do you start if there's certain areas where it seemed to me that sometimes even having certain conversations around things just won't even resonate somewhere because the parts of the brain that need to be on to make sense of that aren't really working so well. So
it's such a good point. And we know Broca's area kind of shuts down, this speechless terror that Bessel spoke of some years ago from an MRI, fMRI from Rausch. And certainly Ruth's work is superbly relevant and of international importance in this area. I mean, I'm a clinician, so I'm not looking at brain scans when I look at my patient. And one of the things I think my patients have taught me is that, I don't know how vivid an example, I have a very good example, it might be a bit too, but it's just so, it's the moment I kind of understood in a way, or I shouldn't say that as though understanding is static, it opened my eyes. Mm-hmm. This young woman had been sexually assaulted as her first sexual experience at 17. On a kind of a date, he was driving her home and he raped her in appalling ways, but almost no treatment. And it's hard to, she taught me a lot. But one of the things that I remember was, every morning, I'd see her in the mornings, and she'd come in and she'd say, "Ugh, I started throwing up or trying to throw up this morning as usual." And she told me some of the details of her rape, and one of them was that she'd been orally raped. And I kept thinking in my psychodynamic way, which is not. It's a good idea. It's a good to be psychodynamic, I think, but you need techniques, which I've enjoyed sort of adding to that little nest. A few good eggs in the nest of techniques are helpful. So this woman, I kept thinking, am I forcing something on her? Am I forcing some therapy on her that's making her, as the oral rape did, kind of throw up? None of those kinds of ideas were, none of them seemed to fly. And then one day, it was just the right kind of timing. She came in and she was holding up her toothbrush and she's saying, every time I brush my teeth, I get to heave. And I said something, I can't remember exactly, but I said something like, oh, does it remind you of anything? Or is that like it was? Some little hint. And she said, oh, "Oh no! Oh, do you think this is? Is it like the oral rape? Is my toothbrush like his penis? Do you think?" And I said, "I don't. You know, I don't know. But what do you think?" And it was like, it was. I mean, these things never usually happen, but it was kind of like magic. That little aspect of therapy. Because she added, "Oh, you know what? He was leaning on my chest. He had his knees on my chest. And I always think I have asthma in the morning or allergies because my chest always feels tight." And with that kind of little realization that she had, and in my own mind, it was like when the implicit becomes explicit, the symptom left. Because she'd found words. Now, helping somebody to find words is very difficult, but I think that you remember that old series on TV, Columbo, mm-hmm. kind of being dumb and curious in a sort of thoughtful way, helps people stumble into their own words. You can't give them the words. I mean, she'd already described the rape, right? That mm-hmm. aspect of the rape. She'd already described it to me, but it hadn't connected.
Yeah.
So one of the things about trauma, which makes it different from grief or other things, is because you don't know what you know. You don't know, I mean, your body knows. I had a patient who was in a fire. And one day, an apartment fire, she was, thank God, fine, shaken. She was rescued. But she came in one day and she said, "I've got flu." And I said, "I'm sorry to hear that. When did it start?" And she said, "Well, I woke up okay. It kind of came on as I was driving to see you." And on carefully sort of breaking it down, what had happened was she'd heard a siren. And she'd have to stop, open her car door, and vomit. She came to it. We sort of found out that was the cause. But she, her body knew. Her body heard a siren and freaked out. But she, her explicit memory, she had no inkling. She found, she confabulated a reason for vomiting. But it wasn't until we just slowed the pace and just carefully walked through that she knew what she knew. So I think that's one of the distinguishing features about trauma, that you can talk a lot about it, but dialogue, as Bessel is always hammering home, rightly so, just chatting or talking doesn't really work. You have to find, spot, and see ways in which the trauma is inaccessible except by sensory means, and mm-hmm. that becomes your focus.
Dr. Payne, you talked a little bit about terrified and trapped being real fundamental parts that had to take place for trauma to occur. And that reminds me a lot of Peter Levine would talk a lot about immobility and fear and those things taking place at the same time. Outside of some of the classic ways that a lot of people would think of being traumatized, like in a severe motor vehicle accident or in abuse situations or in war or something along those lines, what are some of the other ways that might be more widespread that people may not think about or be quite so aware of? Because I know I find a lot of times what you just explained, that's not that far off for a lot of people. A lot of times I find that people can have symptoms, that's things that pop up that they're not necessarily completely cognizant of and until, like you did, where you brought a certain awareness to it and let them sort of come to it on their own. But I think that happens more so than people are aware of. And I'm just wondering if you can go through, what are some of the other ways that that could happen that people just might not think of?
Are the causes of trauma?
Yeah, I an example, one that I've seen a few times now that I thought was really, that I wouldn't have thought about until learning more about it, was even with medical procedures. You know, for example, even I've seen that during one patient that was very traumatized from a
traumatic birth, even one patient from an MRI where they felt like they were immobile and they were really scared around the whole experience of it. Would that be something that would constitute a trauma, or what other ways can that show up?
I mean, it's hard for me to comment on cases that aren't mine, but certainly with that MRI, I would be highly suspicious that that was a trigger, not a trauma. Mm-hmm. That something had happened earlier in that person's life that was terrifying, mm-hmm. and they were trapped. And that was just suddenly a huge they were re-experiencing something because it was so similar. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be quite honest, I don't think I've ever treated a trauma patient who wasn't traumatized by another person's cruelty. Known or unknown. I mean, I think drunken uncles at Christmas may simply not know how cruel they're being, whereas some sexual predators know exactly how cruel they're being. So, what was I thinking of? Oh, yeah. I was called by a family doctor who said, I have a patient who just survived a massacre in such and such country. She's very shaken. Will you see her? I said, yes. She had survived the massacre with remarkable courage and capacity. It was the sexual abuse of her childhood that was killing her. Mm. So I over and over again, I just see mostly sexual perpetrators, but people who are holding hostage in various ways, somebody sexually, physically, or psychologically. I don't know anything else that causes trauma. Mm-hmm. I mean, motor vehicle accidents do, they're complicated, at least being very frank. Mm-hmm. They're complicated in a way because they involve money. And indeed, PTSD was the first, in the First World War, this was a problem then, that soldiers were ultimately, a doctor had to decide, was this a war injury that required a pension, or was it not? And I think we're still at the same stage with car accidents. It's like they are complicated by the fact that insurance is involved, and somehow you have to prove to the people that you are suffering. And that's very complicated. So I think it's easier to treat motor vehicle accidents. People need support. Absolutely, they need support and help. But I think it's easier for people, once the monetary issues have been fixed. And then quite often you find in the treatment of such patients, betrayal traumas are significantly affecting their, it's bound to happen. We are all, we have meaning kind of circuits that build on each other. So my meaning of what happens to me today will definitely refer back to other experiences with other meanings or with similar meanings.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Well, and you'd mentioned a few times back, even with childhood trauma, and I know your book, The Impact of Early Life Trauma on Health and Disease, The Hidden Epidemic. I was looking at some of your work that you've done, and you talk about the adverse childhood experiences, or the ACE score, and the relationship that that has to biopsychosocial health and mortality. And I was astounded. I think I remember at a lecture went a long time back, and Gabor Mate talked about something along those lines too. But the way you broke it down was really quite astounding. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit of what the adverse childhood experiences is and what that ACE score represents and what it can outplay into.
I mean, I it's funny you should be so hit over the head with that. Me too. I remember Bessel, in one of his Boston conferences, brought Folletti with this incredible. The first study was in the year it was written up was 1998, and it was amazing. It was not written by psychiatry or psychology. It was written by basically family medicine people. It was Kaiser Permanente in the States in San Diego. They had a huge, I can't remember the number, something like 17,000 patients who were enrolled in the local family medicine clinics, so that all their past medical illnesses and risk factors were known. And then they were invited to into a survey where they were asked some very simple, very few questions to decide if they had been sexually, physically, or emotionally abused as children. This is all about their childhood. Whether one of their family members had been to jail or had been suicidal, depressed, or had been a substance abuser. I think that's right. Oh, seventh one, who had witnessed their mother being the victim of domestic violence. So there were just seven kind of very simple categories. That elegance is simply that it was yes, no. Didn't matter if you'd been sexually abused 1,500 times or not, or once, you had an ACE score of 1 for all of those seven categories. You got 1, 0, or 1 or more. So your maximum score was 7. And then, like, the people who responded to the survey were middle-aged people, mostly white, mostly with college education. And the sad truth is that the prevalence of their reported abuse or the categories of their adverse childhood experience was kind of not surprising. And I think the sexual abuse category was like 22%, which seems awful. But these were privileged people. It just shows that we can all be very blind to how high the prevalence is of childhood abuse. Anyway, so they scored the people. And then they checked their risk factors. And they're in the West, different in low-income countries. But in the West, there are about 10 risk factors. And they're kind of lifestyle things. It's drug abuse and obesity and depression and suicidal, struggles with suicide, many sexual partners. I don't have them in front of me, but they were they're very important risk factors because they really do demonstrate you're more likely to die of the ordinary things we all die of, but younger. So the morbidity and mortality of the people with higher ACE scores was considerably more than people with low ACE scores. So it was the first time, I believe, that we've ever seen an absolute relationship between psychological injury in childhood and early morbidity and mortality graded. The more ACE, the closer to 7 you had, the more likely you were to die early and to be sick early. Same things that we all die of, like cancer, accidents. I don't know, what else do we die of? Cancer, accidents,
cardiovascular disease.
So it's like, it's not that the illnesses changed, it just meant that you were much, much more likely to get them early and to die younger. Now, they obviously, if you've had a very rough life, you are going to take to bad habits like smoking or drinking or other things that will increase your risk. But they actually organize that statistically to check, despite having those kind of bad habits, whether that accounted for early morbidity and mortality. And they didn't. They still died earlier, even though you could, despite the fact that even without those risk factors being taken into account, they still died younger. And the idea is perhaps there's some kind of stress mechanism that's independent of smoking, drinking, other kinds of risk factors that are going to make you more likely to die early. So I think that taught us, I mean, it was so funny that it was family medicine and not psychiatry that's trying to draw a line between the dots. But I think we have for the first time, and they've gone on to investigate, and they've added, I think, 3 more categories. But that first study, I think, is the change. It's a game changer.
I thought it was huge. And whenever I hear anything about epidemics, whatever they might be, that runs through my head as one of the probably most important things that we should be focusing resources on more than anything, because it's so far reaching in so many different areas, as far as anything from all the different habits right to earlier mortality. I mean, that was really quite amazing. And you could see the higher you got closer to 7, just the increase the percentages went. It was a really simple study to understand what you're looking at too.
You know, while you're talking, I don't know if this is appropriate, but I did look out my slides, because it's early morbidity and mortality is awful. The most extraordinary other points, like early depression, massively more common in the higher the ACE studies, the more the depression. Suicide attempts increase with the number of ACE scores. Antidepressants prescription, hallucinations, interesting enough. Somatoform symptoms increase enormously with increased ACE studies. Memories, impaired memory of childhood increases with the number of ACE studies. Smoking increases. Alcoholism, as self-defined alcoholism, increases. Drug use. In fact, male children with an ACE score of 6 or more have a 46-fold increased likelihood of later becoming an injection drug user compared to a male child with an ACE score of 0. Mm-hmm. Early paternity, early pregnancy, and early intercourse by age 15, teen pregnancy, teen paternity. It goes up, as you could just see these histograms, the higher the score is, the higher the risk likelihood for these difficulties. Job problems, financial problems, again, it all goes up. Absenteeism, serious financial problems, serious job problems, and most tragic of all in some way, like you shouldn't, tragedy isn't comparative, but as you go up in ACE scores, fewer and fewer people live to be 65. In fact, if you've had more ACE score, if you've had four or more ACE scores, your chances of living to 65 are extremely low.
Wow.
So it's extraordinary. It's brilliant. And it's where all, and many, it's a public health. When we wrote the book, we felt so strongly. We said the title should be The Hidden Epidemic, colon. And our publishers said, if you do that, the only people will be watching, the only people who will be reading your book are people who are interested in malaria. Yeah. So we had to make it a subtitle.
You had to preface it.
But it's the most important public health emergency of our time. And if we even if we only care about dollars mm-hmm. to families in need would be well spent.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you completely. I thought that was really important. I
wanted to. Yeah, thank you.
What is the relationship with choice and trauma and the role of meaning in trauma?
Of course this is self-evident, but there's no way we can take away the trauma or the memory of the trauma or the experience of the trauma in a person's life. So I guess therapists, all of us, put our eggs in the is in the basket of trying to help a person reflect on what's happened, so that they have choice. People find treatment in many ways. Therapy is not the only way people recover at all. In fact, it's probably the minority recover. Most people recover because they have good families, good friends, good colleagues, decent work, etc. But for those people who are stuck, it's like their procedural memory doesn't give them enough time to reflect on what's happening. So a bang, you hear a bang in the house. Maybe it's a screen door, maybe somebody dropped something. But people who have not recovered from trauma will jump under the table or cower. That's procedural memory. And it's very useful. In a war, that probably keeps us all alive. But if you're at a conference or, you know, you're running a meeting and you're suddenly ducking under the table, that's really not, it no longer has a useful, it's going to make your life worse, not better. So helping somebody, I don't want to say stop that procedural memory, it's not the right language, but slowing things down so people can see that the loud noise makes them want to jump under the table. Why? And sort of opening that and sort of examining that to free them of this need simply to react will give them choice. Without choice, they just reproduce over and over again the fear circuit or the procedural memory that gets them to move first. And it's no longer adaptive. Mm. Does that make sense? The idea about reflection, in a way, reflection is essential, I would say, but we would take it into mentalizing so that, and for sexual abuse, I continually get drawn back to this as a sort of ultimately the requirement for recovery, that, you know, wonderful people, and I'm going to say women because most of my patients are women, wonderful women who would never blame anyone, any child for being abused, will blame themselves and despise that 4-year-old or 8-year-old or 10-year-old or 13-year-old. They'll hate them. So it's not just reflection. They know they despise that child in them, but it's like taking the part of the child, recognizing that that child was terrified, had no choice, did the best they could. And it's that capacity, it's sort of empathy plus, to understand what they've been through. And it's not even about forgiveness. It's about recognizing how dreadful it is for a six-year-old to be in that position, and never blaming that kid for it. And it's that kind of engagement, really, with the part of themselves that's been walled off in a procedural way that I think ultimately is required, certainly with sexual abuse, before healing can happen. Otherwise, reflection is good, but it can be a little bit academic. It can be a little bit intellectual. And you really want them. And there's some good exercise. There's some good techniques for helping somebody truly respond to their child, the child that they were when they were abused.
When I think about it, in a lot of ways, it's like that. Because then it seems to me that then sometimes what happens is when something's happened to a child, and then that child has a really small tool belt with how to manage their world with. And so then they develop whatever way that they can to manage it, whatever that is, whether that's anger or dissociation or whatever works for them at that point in time, given that they have small skill set to deal with their world around them. And then when those strategies that were almost like survival strategies for them keep happening as they get into adulthood, and now those strategies are creating more troubles for them because they're not necessarily an adaptive way to work with it anymore. How do you begin the process of assisting someone in literally unlearning, or I think you use the term even unusing, the defense behaviors that were once used for protection, but now are not actually helping them anymore? How do you start that process, and what does that look like?
It's so simple and so, for most people, instinctual that the hard thing is to try and identify it scientifically, which of course Peter Fonagy and Alan have all done some brilliant, brilliant work. And I think we have a skill set because our parents or caregivers have behaved towards us with the recognition of our affect. So if you're crying or if you're happy, your caregiver will say, oh, you've just come home from school and you're crying. So the affect is recognized. And then a caregiver will say, what happened? There's always a reason that a kid will cry or be happy or be angry or whatever. And good caregiving, I mean, it's a little bit more than that. But those two linked components kids have a very hard time, because if no one names your affect, in a way you can grow up not knowing what you're feeling. You feel, but you don't have the words to describe it. You're basically sort of functionally alexithymic. So this little process that parents do, we do to each other, it's a very instinct, well, it's only instinctual if you've been lucky enough to have decent caregiving yourself. And a lot of therapy is exactly that. So that if a patient comes in and they're kind of not, something's amiss, you pick up that they're not comfortable or they're not happy with you or something's going on. Because as therapists, we say, oh, Mrs. Smith, is something the matter? It doesn't seem like you're as comfortable as you were last week or whatever. That inquiry, gently and tactfully noting there's a different affect, and then if she says, yes, well, I'm not feeling great today. And then we all say, well, what happened? It's linking those two that then allow a child to recognize their own feelings. Mm-hmm. Like if somebody snatches a toy from them, they'll say, don't do that. It makes me angry. Or they'll know they're angry. They're pissed off or irritated. And it gives you the opportunity to help kids negotiate, right? So somebody snatches a toy. You're angry that Johnny snatched your toy. What are you going to say to him? Are you going to ask for it back nicely? Like, so you start to do these kind of ordinary social skills. But a child can't develop to manage the difficulties that we all face in life if they don't know what they feel. And it's because, of course, if you don't know what you feel, you also can't read the faces of other people. Mm-hmm. Kids who aren't mentalized by their caregivers when they're growing up have no idea how to read the expression on other people's faces. So they're very poorly equipped to understand themselves and understand others. And they'll misattribute motivation to others because they're not reading it right. So what do we do as therapists to help people? We mentalize them. Just like I said, Mrs. Smith, doesn't seem right today. Can you say what happened? Or how are you doing? I try actually as a therapist not to sort of say, how are you feeling? Sometimes that's useful. But as you were saying earlier, experience is very layered. It's built up of a number of kind of building blocks, which are cognitive and physical and psychological, emotional. So I don't want to necessarily zone in on the feeling if she doesn't know what she's feeling. Because mm-hmm. alexithymic patients, they won't be able to necessarily answer you accurately.
This comes to the end of our time for this episode. Please go to inspirehealthpodcast.com and listen to the remainder of this important episode. Thank you so much.